Let's go to Matthew chapter 20. Continue our study through the book of Matthew. And I think we'll take the whole chapter again. Matthew chapter 20, it's 34 verses, not extremely long chapter, but there should be some things there for us to learn. I'm going to go ahead and read the entire chapter this time. Matthew 20, verse 1. For the kingdom of heaven, I should mention before we get too far into this, that if you'll notice that when Matthew wrote his gospel, he likely didn't have a chapter 20 in there. And this is a continuation of Matthew chapter 19. And remember, we finished up Matthew 19 by looking at how Peter mentioned... Well, let's back up even farther. Remember, the rich young ruler left Jesus and said he couldn't follow him because he had too many riches and he didn't want to give them up. And then Jesus said it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God. And the disciples were asking him, Lord, we've forsaken all. What are we going to have? And then Jesus makes this statement in verse 30, many that are first shall be last and the last shall be first. And then I believe that this parable that we're about to read in Matthew 20 is illustrating what he's trying to say, because when he wraps up the parable in verse 16 of chapter 20, he uses the exact same phrase. He says, the first shall be last the last shall be first and the first last. So anyway, just keep that in mind as we read this this parable. Matthew 20, verse 1. For the kingdom of heaven is like unto a man that is an householder, which went out early in the morning to hire laborers into his vineyard. And when he had agreed with the laborers for a penny a day, he sent them into his vineyard. And he went out about the third hour and saw others standing idle in the marketplace. And he said unto them, go ye also into the vineyard, and whatsoever is right I will give you. And they went their way. Again he went out about the sixth and the ninth hour and did likewise. And about the 11th hour he went out and found others standing idle. And saith unto them, why stand ye here all the day idle? They say unto him, because no man hath hired us. He saith unto them, go ye also into the vineyard, and whatsoever is right, that shall ye receive. So when even was come, the lord of the vineyard saith to his steward, call the laborers, and give them their hire, beginning from the last unto the first. And when they came that were hired about the 11th hour, they received every man a penny. But when the first came, they supposed that they should have received more, and they likewise received every man a penny. And when they had received it, they murmured against the good man of the house, saying, these last have wrought but 1 hour, and thou hast made them equal unto us, which have borne the burden in the heat of the day. And he answered one of them and said, friend, I do thee no wrong. Didst thou not agree with me for a penny? Take that thine is, and go thy way. I will give unto this last even as unto thee. Is it not lawful for me to do what I will with mine own? Is thine eye evil, because I am good? So the last shall be first, and the first last, for many be called, but few chosen. And Jesus was going up to Jerusalem. And Jesus, going up to Jerusalem, took the 12 disciples apart in the way and said unto them, behold, we go up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man shall be betrayed unto the chief priests and unto the scribes, and they shall condemn him to death, and shall deliver him to the Gentiles to mock and to scourge and to crucify him, and the third day he shall rise again. Then came to him the mother of Zebedee's children with her sons, worshipping him and desiring a certain thing of him. And he said unto her, what wilt thou? She saith to him, grant that these my two sons may sit, the one on thy right hand and the other on the left in thy kingdom. But Jesus answered and said, ye know not what ye ask. Are ye able to drink of the cup that I shall drink of, and to be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with? They say unto him, we are able. And he said unto them, ye shall indeed drink of my cup, and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with. But to sit on my right hand and on my left is not mine to give, but it shall be given to them for whom it is prepared of my Father. And when the 10 heard it, they were moved with indignation against the two brethren. But Jesus called unto them, called them unto him, and said, Ye know that the princes of the Gentiles exercise dominion over them, and they that are great exercise authority upon them. But it shall not be so among you. But whosoever will be great among you, let him be your minister. And whosoever will be chief among you, let him be your servant. Even as the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister, and to give his life a ransom for many. And as they departed from Jericho, a great multitude followed him. And behold, two blind men sitting by the wayside, when they heard that Jesus passed by, cried out, saying, Have mercy on us, O Lord, thou Son of David. And the multitudes rebuked them, because they should hold their peace. But they cried the more, saying, Have mercy on us, O Lord, thou Son of David. And Jesus stood still and called them and said, What will ye that I should do unto you? And they say unto him, Lord, that our eyes may be opened. So Jesus had compassion on them and touched their eyes, and immediately their eyes received sight, and they followed him. I see there's several divisions here to this chapter. We have our parable in the first 16 verses, and then there's a couple of verses where Jesus is traveling along and he's talking to his disciples and he explains to them about his death coming up again. And this is the third time, I believe, that he mentions it. And then he has a lesson of service. And then he demonstrates service in the last part of the chapter by healing the blind beggars. As I said, I noticed here that it seems like Matthew chapter 20 is an extension of Matthew 19, which it obviously is. And it ties together with the last verse of chapter 19 and the verse 16 of Matthew 20. This story is a little bit maybe hard for us to understand because we don't really go about our lives this way. Those of us who have vineyards, if we have a vineyard, we don't really run to the town square and see who's standing around there and hire them for a day and bring them back home. We don't really do that. But that was the culture. That was the way they did things. You had your tools, you had your skills, you went to the marketplace, you stood there, somebody who needed your services would come and they would agree to hire you. In this case, it was a penny a day, which apparently was a fair wage because the workers agreed to it, and the vineyard keeper, the householder, that's what he offered them. And they were happy with that. He said, all right, go to the vineyard. And he goes out periodically. Apparently, I'm just imagining, but it seems like there must have been a little urgency about this thing. You know, we got to get these grapes in or whatever they're harvesting. And he needs more help. He sees that they're not going to get it done. So he runs back to the marketplace to see if there happens to be a few other people. And sure enough, there's people there. So he sends them to the vineyard as well. And the time frames, we don't go by these things. We don't talk about the third hour and the sixth hour and the ninth hour. But I believe, if I understand these things right, that starting at daybreak, they would measure every 3 hours. And so the probably 6 a.m. was early in the morning is probably when he went out. And then corresponding times, he probably went back out at 9, 12, and 3 p.m. And then also at 5 p.m., the 11th hour would have been probably around 5 p.m. And the pay, as I mentioned, was a penny a day. Now, the interesting thing that you'll notice is that they were paid by the day. Some of us get paid by the week. Some of us get paid every 2 weeks. And some of us might not get paid at all if we own our own business. It seems like we don't. But I want to take you back to the Old Testament, which is, there's a fascinating little verse in Leviticus chapter 19. And I believe this is why this householder did this, paid him by the day. Because in Leviticus chapter 19, verse 13, God is telling the Israelites, these are commands for how you're to operate. And he says this, thou shalt not defraud thy neighbor, neither rob him. Well, that makes a lot of sense. But get the next phrase. The wages of him that is hired shall not abide with thee all night until the morning. In other words, you pay a person for a day's labor when he does a day's labor, and you don't hold that. You pay him every day. It's just fascinating that ties together the Old Testament and the New Testament. It's obviously Jesus knew how to speak to the people that he was speaking to. Anyway, We notice here that at the 11th hour, the master still finds people standing around. In verse 6, he goes out and he finds people still standing, and he's like, "What are you doing? What are you still doing here?" You know, and seems like his perspective is that there's plenty of work to do. He wants all the people he can get, and he doesn't understand why nobody else is hiring these people. It's kind of amazing that there's still people standing around waiting for work. Now, if you can imagine, Winnie, if you can somehow put yourself back into that culture where you have agreed to work for a day's wage, which is a penny, you'll notice that the other people that he hired third hour and the ninth hour and all of that, it doesn't say that they agreed for a penny. He said, "Whatever's right, I'll pay you." So I don't know what kind of money system they would have had, if there was such a thing as 3/4 of a penny or whatever. If we would put it into our perspective, it would be maybe $100 a day. And so if you work 3/4 of a day, you should get $75, right? If you work 1 hour, what would that be? Not very much. But here's what happens at the end of the day. It's time to settle the payment. And he starts with the ones that he dragged in at the 11th hour. And he pays them $100. Now, if you were the first man that came along, you would probably be thinking, wow, $200 maybe? But the next group gets $100 or a penny. The next group gets it. And by this time, you might be thinking, what is going on here? And sure enough, that's what was happening. The first group murmured against the good man because they got their penny that they agreed for. I can only imagine the tension that would have been building in that group as the pay was given out. We'll get to this a little later, but I want to make this comment right now. The master in this story is not stingy as much as he is generous. Just hang on to that thought. He's not stingy as much as he is generous. We'll come back to that in just a little bit. Okay, let's look at the next section. Jesus moves on. He's walking with his disciples the way it seems. He's going up to Jerusalem, and he takes the 12 disciples aside, and he says, "All right, I want to warn you, we're going to Jerusalem, and this is what's going to happen." And notice the details. He specifically knows what will happen. He knows that he will be betrayed, that will turn him over to the chief priests and the scribes, the religious people, and that they are going to find a reason to condemn him to death, and then they're going to turn him over to the Gentiles, and the Gentiles are going to finish up the dirty work. They're going to go ahead and beat him and mock him and crucify him. And Jesus knows all of this, and he's telling his disciples. But he also mentions that he will die, and that the third day he will rise again. Now, it doesn't tell us here how the disciples received this. Earlier in Matthew, you remember some of the times Peter, for instance, he said, no, it's not going to be like that, Lord. But Jesus said, "You don't know what you're talking about." I don't know that I have a lot of comments to make on that, but it's just fascinating to me that Jesus knew exactly what was going to happen, but he's still going to Jerusalem. He is walking to Jerusalem, knowing all the time that one of his 12, Judas was apparently there and heard this, one of them was going to betray him, and that they would find all kinds of reasons to kill him. I don't know where verse 20 starts in the sequence of this. Matthew just writes it like it's all sort of happening at the same time. If we can imagine this request coming from the mother of Zebedee's children, which of course is James and John. Remember, they're going to Jerusalem. There's a lot of political tension in Jerusalem right now. There's a lot of problems with the Roman government. They don't like the Romans. The Romans don't really like the Jews very much. And we have history that tells us there was different uprisings throughout this Roman period. And I believe that there were people that really thought that Jesus was going to go to Jerusalem, overthrow the Romans, set up his kingdom, and this was going to be. And so it seems to me that's a very logical thing for somebody to say, when you come to your kingdom, may we be your cabinet members, or whatever, putting it in our own language here. And I think it's very logical for Zebedee's children's mother to ask this, because I believe, if you remember, when we looked at the genealogy of James and John, it's very likely that these people were cousins to Jesus through their mothers. Very easily could have been. And so it's family, right? You know, if I'm family to a king, I would kind of expect a few perks from that. And I think that this request, while it did raise some indignation in the other 12 or the other 10 in verse 24, was not a request that was just totally off the wall. If James and John's mother thought that she was being dumb by asking it, she wouldn't have asked it. Okay, we don't usually do this kind of thing. I think it was a very logical request. But it wasn't going to fit in Jesus' program, because Jesus says a couple of things. He's like, first of all, you don't even know what you're asking for. Because when I go to my kingdom, like you think I'm going to, it's not going to look like you think it's going to. Do you really want to follow this king to his kingdom? You realize that it's going to take you through. And he asked them, are you going to drink of the same cup and be baptized with the same baptism? And they said, oh, yeah, we'll do that. We'll go all the way. I don't know what they were thinking, but I seriously doubt whether James knew that he was agreeing to be the first martyr, and I seriously doubt that John knew that he was going to be exiled to Patmos for the rest of his life. They didn't know that at that time. And Jesus assured them, you will do this. But I want you to notice something in these verses. Jesus does not reward his followers. He turns that responsibility over to his Father. And I don't know that there's any significance to that at all, but I think there might be. I think there might be a little bit of significance for us, because if Jesus is truly our example, what we're learning here is that we are to allow God to make our decisions and we submit to those decisions. And I'm not sure what all that actually means. But Jesus is content. And I believe that that's still true for us who follow Jesus. I don't believe that Jesus is going to decide who is rewarded how, that he's turning that over to his Father. It's a fascinating concept. And then, of course, we see in verses 25 through 28 that Jesus has some lessons to teach about being great in the kingdom. You see, James and John thought that they were asking for the highest positions that they could, one on the right hand and one on the left, right up there next to Jesus. And Jesus says, we don't do that in verse 26. If you want to be great, you need to be a servant. And then he says that even the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister. When you think about Jesus' life on earth, did anybody do anything for Jesus until after he died? It's kind of hard to come up with anything. I mean, yeah, obviously his parents would have given him a home and a place to live and food to eat and all that kind of thing. But really, the stories that we have about Jesus are all about Jesus doing things for other people. And you don't really find much happening the other way around. Not in a physical sense, anyway. This is a kingdom value system. This makes no sense in the kingdom of the world. Why would anybody say that to be great, you do the lowest chores? It just doesn't make any sense. It's an exercise of faith to believe that this is true. And I find it interesting that Jesus finishes up his teaching with an object lesson. He immediately finds, as they leave Jericho, they're listening, they're probably still thinking about this, they're headed to Jerusalem, and there's this great multitude, and his 12 disciples are there, and these two men, are there and they need help. And they're making a racket about it. And the multitude tells them to be quiet, but they keep on making more racket. And finally, Jesus says, "What do you want me to do?" And he heals them, and they followed him. It's a lovely story, really, to finish up this chapter when you look at the whole concept of what makes somebody great and what doesn't. Well, as you know, it's a little bit hard to go through a chapter like this and not work in practical lessons that we can learn. And so I would like to finish the message by, again, going back over the chapter, since we've kind of gotten the context, and see what we can learn from each of these stories. Let's go back to the parable of the workers. What might we be able to learn? Remember, I said that this story is more about the master's generosity than it is about him being stingy. This story is about people who are not able to accept that God is gracious, and perhaps in our minds, God isn't even fair. Because it doesn't really make sense, does it, that somebody who worked 1 hour gets the same wage as somebody that worked 12. That doesn't really feel fair, does it? The master in the story did not cheat anybody. He kept his promises, and I believe the wage that the laborers agreed to was fair. They wouldn't have agreed to it if it wasn't, unless they were really down and out, but I don't think that was the case. So let's remember that this parable is about grace. It's about generosity. It's about God being kind and gracious to every single person. And it doesn't matter what time of the day the person comes. And we can compare the day to a person's life. You know, there's some of us who come to God very young, and we come to Christ, and we live our whole life for Christ. And we really try to serve other people like we learned that Jesus teaches us we're supposed to give this up. Or like Peter, maybe. Maybe we feel like Peter when we say, "We have forsaken all and followed thee." We feel a little bit like we've done well. And we probably have. I don't think that there's really any argument about these workers that worked 12 hours. They probably did a good day's work. I think they did. But God will save people whether they come to him at 10 years old or whether they come to him at 90 years old. And it doesn't really matter how long they've hung around in the marketplace. God is happy to have them. There's work to be done. He wants them in his vineyard. The problem with this story, again, isn't the master. It's the people that are working for the master. And I want us to try to get a hold of that, because we can so easily be just like the disciples. We can so easily come to Jesus and say, "Behold, we have forsaken all. What shall we have therefore?" And I'm getting that from Matthew chapter 19. Or we can be like the people here in the story, that when they receive their penny, they look at the good man and they murmur. You know, I believe that when we look at these situations, when we are tempted to feel like these people, and I think we all are, maybe I'm just telling on myself, but I kind of think we all are a little bit this way, that God is too gracious with some people. He just really has too much time for some people. And it isn't really right that some people get the rewards of salvation when they've squandered their lives in the marketplace. But I believe we have the wrong view of the work. I believe that we have looked at God's vineyard as something that, instead of being a privilege to be called into God's vineyard, we look at it as God's lucky to have us in his vineyard. Okay, there's a huge difference in the way we think. The people that were hired at the 11th hour and received a penny probably thought the master was a wonderful master, and they were glad for the opportunity to be in that vineyard even for an hour. Whereas the people who worked for 12 hours were saying, "Wait a minute, it wasn't worth this." And God forbid that we would ever feel that way about serving Jesus Christ? Why would we, when we see somebody come to Jesus at the 11th hour, why would we say, you know what, I could have hung around in the marketplace that much longer? But we do that, don't we? Aren't we tempted with those thoughts sometimes? We think that people are, they get to have all the fun and then they get all the rewards of salvation. And I think that's why the world looks so appealing to us, because we think, well, you know, I could go and serve myself and sin and the devil. And then all of a sudden at the very 11th hour, then I would hurry up and go work for the master. I believe that when we have that view of God's work, when we have that view of the privilege of serving Jesus, we probably won't do a very good job in the vineyard, for one thing. And for another thing, I believe that it will waste our lives. And I'm really not sure that God's going to feel like giving us a penny if that's the way we feel about working for Him. I'm not sure how God looks at all of that. But let's not be caught up in that temptation. Let's not have that view of working for God. We should be glad that we were in the marketplace at 6 a.m. and that we had the opportunity of being there the whole day, instead of wishing that we had hung around. Another thing that I think we can learn from this is that God's grace is an equal gift to all men. And we should rejoice in the fact that it is a gift to all men. I've been using this parable to apply to our lives, in the sense that we come to Christ and we work for Him in our lifespan. But this day could also be applied in a completely different way. And I want to try to make this very plain. This parable could also apply to the Jews and the Gentiles. You see, we Gentiles are sort of the 11th hour people. We did not labor under centuries of the law to finally get the rewards of Jesus Christ. The Jews did. And many of the Jews, when Jesus came, they were like these people. They said, "What? You're making the Gentiles equal with us? We've borne the burden in the heat of the day. This isn't right." And they rejected Jesus based partly on that. And so I want us to remember that this parable, while it can apply the way I applied it earlier, also applies in a very broad sense, that we are the 11th hour people and that we are very blessed. Romans talks about this, that we should not boast in the fact that we have been brought in. And we've been able to do that with no bondage of the law. It's all been through grace. You get a penny, even though you haven't worked for centuries under the law. Well, I suppose there's more that could be said on that. I'm going to move on. I would like to talk now a little bit about what we can learn from Jesus predicting His death again. I'm not sure what all to take from this, but one of the things that stood out to me as I looked over this is to think about the word betrayal and to think about the context in which betrayal is always used. Betrayal does not apply to what our enemies do to us. It applies to what our friends do to us, right? We kind of expect enemies to stab us in the back if they get a chance, but we don't expect our friends to. And so it just brings an amazing thought to me that Jesus was standing there talking to 12 disciples. If he knew all of these things that were going to happen, he surely knew who would betray him, right? And he's there talking to these people. I don't know if Judas at this point knew what was going to happen. Later in the gospel, it seems like maybe it kind of grew on him. There was probably something growing right now in Judas, but I don't know that he was really feeling condemned by this. I don't think he had it in his heart at this point to do that. He was going to wait and see what Jesus was going to do. That's my belief. But Jesus is betrayed by friends. And our friends are betrayed when we turn against them and we pretend to be their friends and we're not their friends, depending on which crowd we're with. And we would like to say that that's a young people's problem, that betrayal is a young people's problem, but betrayal is an old people's problem too. We're all tempted to play the traitor sometimes, depending on the relationship. Depends on how difficult the relationship is, or depends on how difficult that person makes my relationship with them. And a person may think that I'm their friend, but suddenly realize that they're not, depending on how I behave. I'm taking a lesson just from the word betrayal. There's nothing really in this passage that would merit those comments. I was going to talk just a little bit as I thought about what to mention here, what we could learn of ways that we can betray Jesus. But I think I'm going to hold on to that idea until we get to the actual story of Judas's betrayal. Lord willing, we will get there sometime this year in the book of Matthew. It's not very long yet until we find that Judas does his act of betrayal. It's in about Matthew 25 or 6, something like that. And so I'm going to just hold on to that of talking about how we can currently betray Jesus when we get to the fulfillment of this prophecy in Matthew chapter 20. The third thing that I want to talk about here in this prediction of Jesus' death, something that we can learn from it, is that Jesus told his disciples three times that he was going to die, that he was going to rise again. It's always about the same words. But his disciples were still unprepared for the reality of it. And I don't know what all we can learn from that, except that when we read the scripture and we see the words in red, as it were, we see Jesus' words, that they will come to pass if they haven't already. And that Jesus means exactly what he says. When he says things like the next section where it says that if you want to be great in the kingdom, you have to be a minister or a servant. That's really all it means. How many times do we read those verses and we still don't really believe it? We still think that we have to exercise authority to be great. It's just a thought. But Jesus tells us things over and over again, and we need to learn from the disciples that it is possible to hear Jesus' teachings over and over and over, and it still doesn't sink in. We need to just take it by faith, obey it the best that we can, the best that we know how. Moving on to serving others, the next section. What can we learn from this? Some of this we've already touched on, just mention it again, that I believe that this story of James and John's mother coming to Jesus and asking for this kind of ties back into what Peter was asking. We have forsaken all and followed thee. What shall we have therefore? Notice verse 20. The mother of Zebedee's children came worshiping him and desiring a certain thing of him. How many times does our worship consist of those two elements? And then the next question is why? And then the next question is why, or should it? Should it consist of two things? How many times do we come to Jesus desiring a certain thing of him, and otherwise we let Jesus alone? I don't like to think about that too long, because it's kind of condemning to think about how many times it's, we love you, Jesus, now would you do us this favor? And really, we're treating God like the heathen people treat their idols when we do that. Jesus is worthy of our worship even if he gives us nothing. His vineyard is worth working in even if there's no pay at the end of the day. Do we really believe that? I don't know if I do. I want to believe that. I feel like the old man in Scripture that said, I believe, help my unbelief. But I really think that that's what Jesus is trying to get across here. That when we agree to work for him, that we are, that worship and desiring things of him are not necessarily they don't go together necessarily. It's okay to ask things of Jesus, but our worship needs to be there all the time, whether he gives us something or not. But so many times we think this way, that God doesn't work. Jesus doesn't work because he isn't answering our prayers. Well, what prayers are we praying? What's our worship consist of? Is it just about me? Or is it about what Jesus can get from me? Or is it what I can get from Jesus? I feel like I'm kind of rambling on that. But let's think about it. Worshiping him and desiring a certain thing of him. Is there anything to worship Jesus for without asking favors? Absolutely. Another thing that we learn from this passage is that to reign with Christ, we must live with him and endure and die with him. I get that from 2 Timothy. Jesus doesn't say it in this many words, but it basically says the same thing. I'll just read it to you, 2 Timothy chapter 2. It is a faithful saying, for if we be dead with him, we shall also live with him. If we suffer, we shall also reign with him. If we deny him, he will also deny us. If we believe not, yet he abideth faithful. He cannot deny himself. So, what we just read in Timothy fleshes out what Jesus is saying right here. He says, all right, I can't guarantee you that you will sit on my right hand and on my left hand, but if that's what you want, you're going to have to go all the way with me. You're going to have to suffer. You're going to have to die. You're going to have to be baptized with my baptism, which we know was the baptism of the cross. And Timothy says the same thing. If we want to reign with Christ, if that's really our desire, it's actually not that hard to do, except that it is. We simply live with him and die with him, and then we will reign with him. And again, that actually takes a life of faith, because at the end, we are trusting what Jesus said. There isn't really any rewards here that we can get a hold of that would show us that that's true. We have to believe it. And you know, James and John learned what that meant. Peter learned what it meant. There's a lot of martyrs that have learned what that means. And in reality, they know what it means. There's probably a whole message that could be preached on the authority concepts that are here in Matthew chapter 20. I'm not sure what all to say here, other than that we are human enough that we understand the concept of Gentile dominion. And I believe that it is a constant struggle in our hearts and in our minds to understand truly and to practice faithfully servant authority. No matter what place of authority you find yourself in, it will be a constant struggle because we understand Gentile authority. That's pretty native. But to believe that a person can exercise authority in the kingdom of God by serving other people takes a lot of faith. Again, we're back to faith, right? I don't know how to make it any plainer than that. It just is that way. I actually believe I actually believe that we're all spiritual authorities to follow this pattern that we might actually think we have chaos. It might actually look like we're losing it. Because Jesus looked like he was losing it. But we would say now that Jesus is the King of Kings, right? And so I'm wondering sometimes if the reason we don't want to, the reason that we shy away from this concept is because it would really look chaotic. Possibly. I'm not sure. But I suppose if we were all truly kingdom Christians, then it would all work out. I'm not sure. Those are some thoughts going through my mind. Let's finish up by looking at the last part. Jesus demonstrated his belief system. He demonstrated the kingdom system of service by healing two beggars, blind men sitting by the wayside. Jesus had time for these blind men. He had more time for these people than he did for people who could already see, in a sense, if you think about it. And the lesson, of course, is that we need to spend our time helping people who need help. People that may not even know they need help. The other thing I would like to just conclude with this morning is a challenge. What would you ask of Jesus if you had the opportunity to answer the question in verse 32? Suppose you're crying out to Jesus and he stands there and says, "What do you want me to do?" What would your answer be? We kind of touched on this the last time we looked at Matthew 19. But it's such a challenging thought. What would our answer be? I think that the answer should probably be the same as the blind men. Now, we can all see this morning, most of us can. But we still all have a blindness in our spiritual lives that keeps us from seeing the reality of what God wants to do in our lives. I think we should ask God to open our eyes to the needs around us. I think we should ask God to open our eyes to the jealousy and the competition in our hearts. I think we should ask God to open our eyes to the tendency to ask the question, "We have left all, what reward have we?"